In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, a potent new fat loss workout. Is foam rolling bad for your IT band? Why I eat bread. Can you eat avocado seeds, or for that matter, brown avocados? And five things you must know about nutrition.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Speed. Mobility. Balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Rachel, I'm going to have to admit that based off of the discussion we were having before we began recording this morning, I'm actually blushing.
Well, I blush every time I talk about this as well. So let's see if we can get through it without too much awkwardness.
Seriously, you may want to put earmuffs on the kids just real quick. We promise. If you're listening, may recall at one point we had an interview with this gal named Kim Amani, who runs like workshops for women and for men in the realm of intimacy. And Rachel, can you tell me a little bit about Kim's new course that you've just started?
Yeah, well, for starters, it all came about because Ben doesn't like to endorse anything that he hasn't experienced. And this is actually called a vaginal kung fu course. And obviously, Ben's a man and he can't do it.
I don't have a vagina.
So he sent me to do it. Very exciting stuff. Now, I know a little bit about Kim Amani, and I'd kind of experienced her a little bit before, and I found her to be quite provocative. You know, she talks a lot about shooting ping pong balls out of your vagina, and
she lifts kettlebells with her vagina.
She does. Yeah, and it can be, I don't know, I found it a little bit uncomfortable. And honestly, for that reason, I felt like it was something that I needed to explore. So when you were like, Rachel, do you want to do this course? I thought, well, yeah, of course I do. So it's been a really interesting experience so far. It's definitely nowhere near as provocative as I thought it would be. In that respect, it's actually very holistic.
Are you hoisting coconuts yet?
Not yet, no. We actually just started talking about the jade egg last week. I know, we'll get there though.
Yeah, you got to move from an egg to a coconut pretty quick in order for me to be impressed. For you guys who might be feeling left out, you may want to go to bengreenfieldfitness.com and read the episode read the article where I wrote about a 30-day training session that I did with this magnetic weight called the Private Gym, which I still whip out every now and again when I want to get a good little penile weightlifting session, if that is a term that we can use.
And I don't know if this was the intention of the Private Gym, but a lot of it is around like conscious sex education and about really developing a relationship with your genitals, as weird as that sounds. But for a lot of us, we don't really, you know what's going on a lot of the time down there. So
I've got a great relationship with my genitals. I can look down.
I do now.
I can see them. I know what they look like. I know what they feel like.
Yeah.
I know what they're named. I know how to use them. So I would say my relationship is solid.
News flashes.
And now is the time in the show where Ben brings us all of the juicy stuff he's been telling the world on social media.
Juicy social media things. You know, actually, this particular section of the news flashes might be a little bit more voluminous than previous episodes because a couple things just came across my radar this morning. Of course, prepare for the URL onslaught. Things I've been tweeting about at twitter.com/Ben Greenfield. Things I've been Facebooking about over at facebook.com/BG Fitness.
Ben. Instagram.
Yes, Instagram, where we've got plenty of bloody posts that I'll hopefully talk about here pretty soon over at instagram.com/Ben Greenfield Fitness. I memorized all those.
Good for you. And we've also got a whole bunch of really exciting giveaways happening on Facebook in the next few weeks. We're giving away 2 tickets to PaleoFX, Tough Mudder Race Code, some Organifi green juice that we always talk about on the podcast, and our favorite coffee, Chimera Coffee.
Jeez, it's a lot of giveaways. Yeah.
It's a lot going on.
For next time on Facebook. Okay, so let's jump into the good stuff. Wellness FX just this morning has announced this pretty cool, really, in my opinion, for anybody who's into self-quantification and health, probably one of the coolest announcements I've seen all year. They have developed the ability for people from their own home to order advanced blood chemistry, hormone testing, genetic testing, and microbiome, which would be like skin and poo and mouth testing, to their home. All done using a pretty advanced DNA analysis that I won't get into too intensively now. I will link to this announcement, this special announcement, this press release that came out today. Needless to say, you know, for me, as someone who recommends to a lot of people to keep track of their blood results and their poop results and their microbiome and their DNA, having it all appear to be in one mighty spot now from the comfort of your own home, this happened way, I thought this would be something that would be like a year or two out. But it's the way it's working now, and I'll link to the press release, but you can simply go to the Wellness FX website now and kind of like apply to be one of the first people to go through this new home testing kit.
So obviously home testing, you don't need to get blood drawn.
You do, but it's in the comfort of your own home, meaning I believe it is a blood spot test for the blood. And then, of course, like the genetics would be saliva, the microbiome would be skin and poo. But yeah, you just basically send out all these little pieces of your body to Wellness FX. So I think it's pretty cool.
And then the final thing, the questions that we always get around Wellness FX is they're not available in a couple of states in Canada. Do you know if they're going to be doing this for Canada, at least?
Just move to the USA. Things are better down here. Just saying. No, I actually have a lot of Canadian clients, and what I will have them do is when they're visiting the United States, I'll have them order kits to their address, like a DNA kit or a blood testing kit. They'll get the kit done while they are in the US, and then when they travel back to Canada, they'll get the results emailed to them.
Yeah, perfect.
And I don't know if that's legal. They may be arrested by the Canadian bobbies at some point in the near future. But I'm just saying, that's how we do things now. Another cool announcement is that for those of you, so for all the clients who I coach, I use something called Training Peaks. So when I sit down and I write a training plan, like this morning I was working on one for a mountain biker who I'm coaching. And when I'm sitting down and writing out workouts, et cetera, I use this program called Training Peaks. It's just simple. It's a calendaring system that lets people see the workouts that I lay out for them. And then they can also upload things like their sleep and their heart rate or their power or their speed, you know, whether it's someone who I'm coaching for anti-aging or for triathlon or obstacle racing. It's the program that I use. They just, for those of you using it or those of you who want to use it, they just introduced the ability to add, in addition to like your sleep and your soreness and your workout comments and everything else, heart rate variability. So now, now heart rate variability will appear as a metric on Training Peaks. They've actually partnered with Sweetbeat, which is the company that actually runs the engine behind the app that I developed for heart rate variability, the NatureBeat app. So if you own the Ben Greenfield NatureBeat app, you can grab a free Training Peaks account and start to upload your heart rate variability data to that.
Well, that is awesome.
We've just made all the nerds on Earth very happy. the nerd athletes. So check that out. We'll put links to both of those, the Wellness FX and the Training Peaks, in the show notes. Oh, but wait, there's more. As they say.
Plenty more, actually.
That's right. First of all, a research study that just came out that looked into short-term, high-intensity, intermittent training to see how quickly you could lose fat with this type of training. They compared it to lower-intensity training, what they call moderate-intensity continuous exercise. What they did in this study was they had a group of women on a bicycle, and I actually tried this workout the other day just to see what it felt like. They had them do 15 60-second bouts. Okay, so 15 separate 60-second bouts on a bike, and each effort had 30 seconds of recovery after it. So pretty straightforward, right? A 2-to-1 work to rest ratio.
Yep.
I'm just saying that because it makes me sound smart versus 60 seconds on, 30 seconds off. And what they found was that the group that did this just 3 times a week, okay, so if you do the math, that's 15 1-minute bouts, 30 seconds of recovery, so approximately a 22-minute long workout.
Yep.
3 times a week, they experienced a significant decrease in fat mass, more than 6 kilograms, which is over 12 pounds of fat lost in 6 weeks. And the clincher for this study, in my opinion, is that there was no diet. They didn't change up their diet at all. They held their diet constant. All they did was add in 3 times a week of a 15 1-minute efforts, each followed by 30 seconds of rest at a pretty high intensity. And they saw a pretty shocking drop in fat, in my opinion. And it's just another feather in the cap of high-intensity interval training.
So how did it relate to the moderate intensity?
The moderate intensity still saw pretty good results. But here's the interesting thing about moderate intensity exercise, or even what we call LISS, low-intensity steady-state exercise. And we've talked about this on the podcast, most recently with Mark Sisson. We see a decrease in testosterone. We see an increase in hunger and appetite and what's called compensatory eating after that kind of training. And with high-intensity training, you don't see that. And one of the proposed mechanisms for this is that when you train with high intensity, you produce a lot of lactic acid. And lactic acid can not only shut down appetite, but it can also get converted via a process that's called the Cori cycle, C-O-R-I, the Cori cycle. It can get converted into glucose. So your body can take lactic acid, produce fuel for your body after a high-intensity workout, and you're not as hungry compared to if you did the same amount of volume or burnt the same amount of calories with a lower-intensity type of workout.
Interesting.
Yes, it's the magic of exercise science. So
high-intensity win again.
It wins once again. So another really cool article that came out from our friends over at the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. This was an article entitled, and I'll read it to you, Dietary Supplementation During Musculoskeletal Injury, Protein and Creatine. The idea behind this article that I'll link to in the show notes was that a lot of people, when they get injured, they'll stop taking things like protein or creatine because, frankly, why take, you know, anabolic muscle building supplements or recovery supplements if you're not working out that much?
Working out, exactly. Yeah.
So what this study looked into was whether if you keep taking protein and creatine, or it's really more of an article than a study because it's just like highlighting a bunch of studies that have been done on this in the past. They looked at whether or not if you continue to use protein and creatine when you're injured, if it can accelerate injury recovery. And they found some really, really interesting things. For example, one of the things that they found was that taking on a daily basis about 8 to 12 grams of essential amino acids, okay, that would be like amino acid capsules or powder, mm-hmm. along with 20 to 25 grams of protein can assist with healing damaged muscle tissue. And in this case, what they looked at was healing of the anterior cruciate ligament, the ACL, after an ACL sprain. And so the consumption of protein along with essential amino acids actually caused a faster recovery of healing tissue. And so I thought that was quite interesting.
So the moral of the story?
Well, there's actually more.
Oh, but wait,
there's more. I'll keep throwing around that phrase. I'll kick that horse to death all day long. hip fracture. This was an elderly subject. They found same thing. Protein supplementation, in this case with just, you know, basic protein powder, during the course of healing from a bone injury, help the bone to heal faster. And then they turned and they looked at creatine. Now, in the case of creatine, one of the interesting things is that when you're injured, when a muscle is immobilized and you're unable to exercise that muscle, you see a reduction of over 20% in this specific transporter called GLUT4. All right, I'm going to get all geeky again. So GLUT4 is a protein that helps your body to transport glucose into muscle tissue, transport energy into muscle tissue so that muscle can be used for metabolic activity.
Yep.
The interesting thing is that if you see a downregulation in GLUT4 when you're injured, once you do bounce back from that injury, it's going to limit your ability to be able to feed fuel into muscle tissue. Now, what they found was that During rehabilitation from injury, in this case it was leg injury, supplementation with creatine staved off that reduction in GLUT4, meaning when people continued to use creatine while injured, they didn't experience the same deficit in the body's ability to be able to feed fuel to itself.
Wow.
So case in point, once again, if you are injured, it's actually better to keep taking some of these things that you're taking, like creatine or protein, if you're already taking them. The other thing they found was with creatine after an acute injury, right, like an inflammatory muscle damage injury, right, like an ankle sprain, they found that a 5-day dosage period of creatine, and this would be taking about 5 grams of creatine per day, resulted in significantly lower levels of inflammatory markers like creatine kinase and something called pyruvic acid transaminase. And so it turns out that creatine seems to be acting as kind of like a potent anti-inflammatory for people who are injured. You know, and of course, if you want to step back and look at this from, you know, if you eschew supplements and you're not into like taking powders and capsules and stuff like that, what's one source of very potent source of creatine and protein? It's steak. So, you know, it goes to show you if you're injured, I know you're vegetarian, Rachel, so you may have to go more of like the hemp pea rice protein creatine route. Okay. But steak, I mean, if you are injured, throwing back a steak. I actually have a nice ribeye steak thawing in the refrigerator upstairs right now. I'm not injured. I'm just hungry.
Just like steak.
I'm just hungry. So that's a good reason to keep using a protein and creatine if you are injured. And then finally, here's a good one. Talk about steak. We might as well talk about bread. Mm-hmm. Really good article over at Earth Easy. Now, I personally eat bread several times a week. As a matter of fact, my wife makes 1 to 2 big old loaves of fresh baked sourdough bread each week. And I will do things like toast it and eat it with my salad. Or like in the evenings, you know, for example, last night we had some sauerkraut and sausage with stone ground mustard and some sourdough bread. And we certainly don't avoid bread here at the Greenfield household. Yeah. And this article actually goes into bread and wheat particularly. And, you know, one sentence in the article says wheat, it turns out, is not just wheat. And new biotech companies like Monsanto have used genetic engineering to increase wheat's resistance to things like herbicides and pathogens and drought and salinity, which would be high levels of mineral in the soil. But the problem is that in many cases, that type of breeding can change wheat into an edible wild plant that your body actually doesn't recognize. And often it concentrates the amount of gluten proteins in that wheat and makes it, you know, essentially renders it less digestible. A lot of these wheat germ agglutinins that we find in something like wheat, they're about as digestible as human hair.
Oh my gosh.
Now, when you look at something like bread, this certainly gives you one clue, and the article goes into this, that the source of the wheat, what are called the wheat berries used to make the bread, are something you need to take into consideration. Like my wife, for example, uses a form of red wheat berry from right here on the Palouse in you know, very close to our house. You can order this kind of stuff online, but it's a non-GMO, more ancient form of wheat that hasn't been bred for high yield crop or anything like that. Now, then what she does is she traditionally ferments the wheat using a sourdough method. Mm-hmm. So what happens with that is it actually makes the proteins in the wheat significantly more digestible because lactic acid is produced during the long rising process of what's called slow fermentation. When you slow ferment bread, and the article goes into some things that a lot of people might not know, its effect on blood sugar is much gentler. You have a much lower blood sugar response to bread products that have been produced via this process of what's called slow fermentation, this sourdough type of process. Gluten gets digested very, very well during that process. So gluten is like pre-digested. So not only is the bread not spiking your blood sugar, and so you have a lower glycemic response, but the bread also is less likely to cause issues in people who have, for example, like gluten intolerance. And it's also, by the way, damn tasty.
Right. I love sourdough bread. It's incredible. And you don't necessarily, I love the idea of making everything yourself just once so you understand the process, you understand what should and shouldn't be in your food. And we get incredible sourdough from a local bakery that kind of takes a lot less time. So
Yeah. So slow fermentation using sourdough, very easy technique to use. My wife, if you just do a Google search for Jessa Greenfield sourdough, my wife has some pretty good videos out there with her sourdough recipes. And we've also, we covered her recipe a little bit in a previous podcast. So you could even go to bengreenfieldfitness.com and do a search for sourdough. But I get this question all the time. So I thought I'd reply. Yes, I eat bread. Yes, I eat bread often every day. That's the type of bread that I eat. And I eat it because it tastes good. It brings a big smile to my face. And it's almost 100% guilt-free. What do you think, Rachel? Q&A time?
Q&A time.
Listener Q&A.
Hi, Ben. This is Ali from Hong Kong. I just wanted to get your opinion on rolling and rolling with improving the IT band. I recently read an article that said iliotibial band, please do not use a foam roller, written by a sports surgery clinic. And I wanted to get your opinion on that. I can send you the link to the article. But basically, if you did a Google search for Andrew Franklin Miller, Director of Research and Development at Sports Surgery Clinic LTD, he wrote an article on the 2nd of February saying, iliotibial band, please do not use a foam roller. And just wanted to get your opinion on that. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Rachel, do you foam roll?
I do foam roll. We've got a bright orange one in our living room that does not go with our decor at all, which is a little bit offensive to me, but I still use it.
That just won't do.
It won't do. Seriously. Like, you had to choose that color?
You could paint it.
Wouldn't? Yeah, maybe.
Or drape it in something. I have that same orange foam roller. It's actually a good one. It's quite hard. Even though my favorite is still the rumble roller, which is the foam roller that has all the ridges coming off it that dig into your muscle tissue as you roll. And I roll almost every day. I'm on that thing. I've talked about this before in a podcast, how when I go downstairs and I put the coffee on in the morning, I just pick a few body parts and I roll them. And then I do some traction with an elastic. And I actually, just this morning, I was packing because tomorrow morning, I am going to Hawaii. And I have a collapsible foam roller that I packed into my bag. And then I also put my big, thick, elastic band in there. And those are just a couple little travel tools that I throw in. In this case, I'm going hiking in Hawaii for a few days with some fellas who I'm part of a business mastermind with. And so we're going to do some hiking. But I'm also, of course, bringing my foam roller so I can do some deep tissue work. And I looked at this article that Ali referred to called Iliotibial Band. Please do not use a foam roller. This article, I liked it because it was nerdy. What it went into was cadaveric anatomy. They took a bunch of adult cadavers. Dead people, basically. Mm-hmm. And they looked at the IT band. They did some dissections of the IT band, and they found that there's like this bursa on the IT band. There's a bursa, like a fat pad in the IT band. And they show some of this fat pad, and what they noted was that the way that this fat pad is oriented is such that if you were to be doing traditional foam rolling on the very outside of your leg, on your IT band, you could actually cause some friction against this fat pad and some actual inflammation in the IT band that could theoretically aggravate something like IT band friction syndrome, or risk for like pain on the outside of your knee, or pain on the outside of the hip. What they found in this particular inspection of these cadavers was that if you wanted to reduce tension on the IT band without actually aggravating this bursa, rather than rolling the IT band, you should instead roll or do deep tissue work on a couple other areas of the body, specifically something called your gluteus medius, which you can kind of hit by crossing your legs like you were sitting cross-legged in a chair, and then kind of shifting the right side of your butt over the foam roller and foam rolling like that. And then also something called the TFL, Which is kind of like the best way to target that is you roll a little bit higher up in your hips and your pelvis area. You could even Google TFL foam roller to see some videos of exactly how that's done. Now, I 100% agree with this, and I personally do not roll my IT band because I do know that it can cause some compression of some of this tissue that's not supposed to be compressed. Plus, the IT band is so freaking hard and tense that you're almost wasting your time rolling it. Right. Now, the area that I do roll if I want to free up external rotation in my hips is I hit that gluteus medius, right? So I'll fold over my leg and sit in a cross-legged position and get the outside of the hip and the glute that way. But then also, if you feel along the outside of your leg, and if you're listening in, you can do this. You can feel the outside of your leg where it's really, really like tight, and that's your tensor fascia latae and your IT band that kind of goes up and down through there. Even though just so the anatomists who are listening in, don't try to leap through the podcast and throttle me. The TFL or the tensor fascia latae is technically kind of on the front outside of your leg. And that area you can roll a little bit, but then when you go farther down your leg, you get into the IT band, and that's the area that you'd want to stay away from. But then as you're feeling yourself all up and down your leg, you'll notice that as you move your hand more and more towards the front of your leg, it starts to get soft and muscly, and that's your quadricep. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is that there's a little part right there's the part where it's like hard and stringy, and that's your IT band. And there's a part where it's soft and muscly, and that's your quadricep. But there's a part right in between there, kind of like if your quadriceps were at noon, we're talking about the area that would be like between about 1 and 2 p.m. Right?
Yep,
around
I got
there.
It.
Okay. If you roll that area, what it does is it separates the quadricep from all that fascia that's right around your IT band. And that can do a really good job freeing up external rotation and mobility. So that's the area you want to roll, kind of like the front outside of your leg rather than the outside of your leg.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So yes, it's true that the IT band is pretty much just a tendon that doesn't respond well to rolling. And this recent study on cadavers shows that it also has bursa in it that can get inflamed if you're putting pressure on it from rolling. But you should roll your TFL, the front outside of the leg, the glute, the back outside of the leg, the quadricep, kind of like the front diagonal part of the leg, but not the IT band. So that's the kind of foam rolling that I do.
Hi, Ben. It's Meg from Marietta, Georgia. And what's up with corns? I am an active, very active, you know, Ironman athlete. I'm a very young 52-year-old female, and I think I'm way too young to have something like corns. And anyway, it's bugging the crap out of me, and I don't know what to do about it other than surgery. So let me know what you think and if there's any other way I can get around surgery. I love the show. Keep up the great work, and thanks so much. Bye.
So, Ben, what is a corn?
What is it? Are you kidding me? Do you have corns in Australia?
I think we do. I think they're the big things that grow on your feet. Are they like cysts? What is inside them?
They're not
Tell me
cysts.
Everything.
They're very simple. They're these little circles of thickened and hard skin that develop from like friction and pressure, not to be confused with corn kernels or ears of corn, which would be super nasty if those were on your feet. I don't know why they're called corns, but your body just forms these little protective armors to protect the tissues from this continuous friction. Calluses, you know, on your fingers is very similar to like corns on your feet. But the problem with corns is that A, they can be unsightly if you happen to be wearing high-heeled shoes, barefoot, or something like that. And they can be kind of annoying. They can even get painful if they get really, really like big and hard, and you can feel them kind of rubbing against your shoes.
Right, yeah.
How do they happen? Well, you can have incorrectly fitted shoes, typically shoes that are too small, which put excessive pressure on certain parts of your foot. Shoes that are loose can also damage the foot through repeated friction, but usually corns are due to your shoes being too small. Not wearing good socks, right? Like, I'm a big fan of like wool socks and synthetic socks versus cotton socks, or even just like wearing sandals that are really rough and that cause friction on the skin. Yeah. That can cause it. Even if you are wearing the correct shoes, just running for long periods of time, as Meg, who is an Ironman triathlete, probably does. Mm-hmm. She doesn't. She's probably a pretty crappy Ironman triathlete.
Still better than me.
Gotta run. But anyways, that you know, any type of chronic repetitive motion, cycling or running, can cause corns. Some people can have like medical issues, right? Like abnormal bone structure, flat feet, you know, faulty foot conditions from some kind of an injury. Stuff like that can also cause calluses and corns. But typically it's just bad socks, ill-fitted shoes, or just like a lot of volume on the feet. Those are the biggies. So,
And then what can she do to get rid of them? Is surgery the only option?
No. For heaven's sakes, don't go out and get corn surgery. That's just a waste of your insurance deductible. Some of the things that you can do. First of all, there is lemon juice. Lemon juice is actually really cool. Lemon juice works well on warts, especially like a lemon essential oil, because mm-hmm. it's really, really concentrated. But just a basic lemon juice, you can apply raw lemon juice, like cut a lemon in half and rub it out, like right on the corn, and then let it dry out. And it turns out that the citric acid in the lemon juice softens the hard upper layer of the corn and gradually removes it. And this is also why anybody who's training for American Ninja Warrior or obstacle racing or Spartan racing or anything like that, don't let lemon juice near your hands, because you'll lose your precious softness. Calluses. Yeah, you want totally. You want your big, big, ugly logger hands.
Is that just the top layer that it does? What do they do for the underneath layers?
Well, there are some other things you can do. A soak can help if it's really deep. The best thing to soak your foot in, don't laugh, but this actually works pretty well. It's a mix of chamomile tea and Epsom salts. So you can take Epsom salts and chamomile tea. What this combination does is it softens the dead cells that deposit on the topmost layer of the corn. And after you do this, you can get out like a pumice stone or a callus file, and you can just basically callus it away. Yep. That was one of the worst things I personally ever did, was when I raced a triathlon in Vietnam. I got a pedicure because like Vietnam is the place to get like pedicures and
totally.
Manicures. Yep. Like $5, you can go in and get like this big. So I was like, I am going to treat myself to a pedicure, baby, because you know, I don't get a pedicure much, actually, sure ever since that? So I got the pedicure, right? Uh-huh. And my foot was beautiful. It was like all wax and all the calluses and the corns and everything off it. And then I went for a run the next day. Mm-hmm. And my feet were like almost bleeding because I'd gotten rid of all of the, you know,
the good stuff.
All that good stuff that my foot needed to protect itself. So, you know, I'm giving you some tips here, Meg, but you may want to consider the fact those corns are doing you a favor. But either way, you could soak for about 10 minutes in chamomile tea and Epsom salts. Don't drink the tea afterwards, by the way, or feed it to anyone. But you can actually remove a corn very easily if you scrub it after you've done that. Baking soda can also work as an option if you don't have chamomile tea and Epsom salts around.
So, Meg, what I challenge you to do is go and do that and then comment and tell us if it actually works.
There are a bunch of other things too. Pineapple, garlic, papaya, those can all help quite a bit. Interestingly, in the same way that those can work on muscle soreness when you consume them, they have things called proteolytic enzymes in them, which can break down fibrinogen, one of the main things in your bloodstream that can lead to excess soreness after a workout. They can also be applied topically to areas of the skin that you kind of like want to wear away a little bit, or that you want to soften. You know, that's why you'll find some proteolytic enzyme type components in many like facial moisturizers and these facial washes and paste that you put on. So those can work too, you know, and there are a lot of other things. There's like tea tree essential oil, there's turpentine essential oil, but basically, you know, the list goes on and on. Now, I have a special type of thing that I smear on my feet when I'm going to be out for a long period of time. And I smear it on my nipples and my balls and my armpits and anywhere where I don't want a lot of friction or corns or calluses or chafing. Because anybody who's like been out doing a marathon knows that over and above a stress fracture or an IT band issue or bonking from lack of energy or anything, a blister is the one thing that every single step makes you grit your teeth and want to quit, right then and there. Blisters are horrible.
Yeah, they're small, but they're mighty.
They're the devil. So there's this stuff that I use. It's made by Hammer Nutrition, and it's called Seat Saver. It was originally applied to just like apply to the chamois surface of like bike shorts, right? Like the thick diaper part of bike shorts. Mm-hmm. But you can put it anywhere. It is olive oil, shea butter, yarrow, chamomile, beeswax, vitamin E, clove, lavender, peppermint. Mm. You want to lick your nipples after you've been for a run. It's so tasty. And
well, they'll feel smooth. Like they're on fire. Yes.
And tea tree oil. And anyways, you put this anywhere that you want to lubricate, anywhere that you want to protect. And the cool thing is that a lot of those ingredients offer lubrication and anti-chafing, but they're also antibacterial, right? So you're less likely to get things like hemorrhoids and infections in a lot of those areas that tend to get inflamed when you're out there doing your chronic repetitive motion stuff. So that's another cool one. We, as the Ben Greenfield Fitness people, get a discount on anything from Hammer Nutrition, including that Seat Saver Cream. You go to hammernutrition.com, and they've got a 15% discount code on this stuff. The code is 80244. I'll put that in the show notes for those of you who don't have memories like steel traps. But that's the stuff I would use, and that's what I would do about your corns, Meg.
So basically, Seat Saver Cream or a fruit salad for her foot.
A fruit salad for your foot, exactly, followed by a nice cup of tea.
Hi, Ben. My name is Erin Young from Hickory Corners, Michigan. And my question is about avocados. I've been told that the pit of an avocado is really good for you, that it contains high amount of flavanols. And it was suggested that I put it in my morning smoothie. And I was wondering what you know about avocado seeds and why that would be beneficial. My other question is, I've heard you talk a lot about oxidation and how avocados can oxidize. And I often eat half the avocado, put it together with the pit, and pull it out later, and it is a little bit brown. Should I be removing that brown from the avocado before I eat that? Is that oxidized avocado, and is that essentially bad for me? Thanks for answering my question, and I'll be listening to hear the answer. Thank you.
Rachel, have you actually seen the video I have about this on YouTube?
I haven't seen the video.
It's called Five Shocking Foods You Can Blend.
Yeah, and I'm going to imagine avocado seeds are on there.
Oh, in the video, I'm blending like eggshells and broccoli stems and flax seeds. And I'm throwing like, I go into like which supplements that you can throw into your blender. And then I also throw avocado seeds into the blender. Because you can, if you're lazy like me, you can just drop the whole avocado into your blender.
Even the skin?
Well, no, not the skin. Skin it and then drop the whole avocado. Sorry, I should
let's just be clear about that.
Yeah. So avocado seeds are kind of cool. They have about 70% of the same antioxidants that you find in the whole avocado, but then the avocado seed oil itself, which you're only going to find in the seed, it's different than avocado oil. So avocado seed oil is different than avocado oil. It's actually higher in antioxidants, and it can assist with things like joint repair. And it works very similar like collagen in that way. It also has more soluble fiber in it than oatmeal. The avocado seed does. So it can like
the veggies and vegans.
Yeah, so it can increase HDL, and it can help with like moving things along your GI tract. It can even be nourishing and healing for inflammation and for like irritable bowel or colitis or things like that. And in South America, actually, avocado seeds are one of the things that they'll use for dysentery and gut problems, things like gastric ulcers and things that arise in your gut. And you can powder. You can, like, even on Amazon, for example, you can buy avocado seed powder. And it's one of those things that's sold to help to soothe the gut. And like I mentioned, avocado seed oil, similar to the avocado seed, it can increase collagen formation. So it can help to keep your joints nice and supple. There was one interesting study that they did on avocado seeds, by the way, that showed that it can help to lower the blood glucose response to your food. So if you like have carbs in a smoothie or something like that, it could actually lower the glycemic index that smoothie would produce. So
is it quite digestible?
If you blend it, I don't recommend chewing on it like a eternal gobstopper, but you could definitely blend it, and it's quite edible. I've never had any issues with it. So yes, you can put avocado seeds into the blender. Now, regarding this question, though, about avocados and whether you can eat them if you're brown.
If they're brown.
Yeah.
You can eat them if you're brown.
You can. if you're brown, you can definitely eat them. If they're brown, you can also eat them. And I think it's kind of interesting, this whole idea behind browning. So if you avocados themselves are quite interesting fruit. So their flesh, as we know, it's mostly fats. It's oleic acid and linoleic acid. So avocados don't have hardly any sugar or starch in them, and they don't even start to ripen until you pick them from the tree. So if you put them in the fridge while they're unripe, they're going to stay unripe. So if your avocados tend to get soft and brown and moldy really fast, keep them in the fridge. Mm-hmm. Now, once the flesh of the avocado gets exposed to air, what happens is that there is an enzyme in the avocados called polyphenol oxidase, and that converts what are called the phenolic compounds in olive oil to something called quinones. And these quinones can manifest themselves as a brown coloration to the avocado flesh. Basically, they gather together to form this big, long chain of polymers, are called polyphenols. And you'll see this occur in a lot of foods. You know, bananas can do this too, and apples. It's basically a browning of these polyphenols. Now, sometimes that can happen if it gets exposed to oxygen, which is what we're all familiar with. But any type of damage can cause this browning to occur. So like if you drop an avocado, you know, a bruise, it's very similar. It's a phenolic reaction. It's like it's like a protective reaction. You can prevent it. So you can, you know, the most common way to prevent this in apples or avocados or anything else is you just get a little lemon juice or lime juice. Mm-hmm. Same stuff you're going to use in the corns on your feet. And you put that on the exposed flesh of the fruit. And these enzymes actually don't work as well in acidic conditions. And since lemon is acidic or lime is acidic, what happens is the avocado doesn't brown as easily. You can also, of course, keep the avocado from being in contact with oxygen by wrapping it in a little like cling film, like plastic wrap after you do it. Some people are a little bit reticent to do that because anytime you let plastic touch your food, you're increasing the potential that you could be consuming phytoestrogens. So you got to be careful with plastic wrap. Like I'll use plastic wrap over bowls full of food, but I'm careful not to really wrap a lot of food in plastic wrap where it's going to touch the parts that I'm going to be eating. So I'm not as big a fan of that as just like laying it down on a plate that has a little lime juice or lemon juice in it. And that can work quite well. So, and as far as eating it, yes, you can eat brown avocados. There are no studies that show it to be an issue. Now, of course, an avocado that is browned and has been exposed to oxygen is going to potentially become moldy more quickly. And so you do want to pay attention to whether or not there's like stringiness or mold. That's when you would, you know, when the flesh gets very stringy, that's when you should avoid eating it because that means that it's becoming quite rancid and moldy. But I cannot talk about avocados without mentioning, since we've talked about vaginal weightlifting and penile exercises and everything else on this show, we might as well stay on that journey. Did you know that avocados are a pretty potent aphrodisiac?
I knew where you were going with that. Yeah. I did not.
You didn't know
this. But I just put two and two together. Yeah. I did not know, but you know what? I have been eating avocado like crazy lately, and it hasn't really, I don't know if it's impacted my sex drive or not. I don't know. But they are just objectively delicious.
Well, the Aztecs actually were quite fond of avocados for those reasons. For example, they had a name. It's like Ahu Kakahuiti or something like that. That roughly translates in Aztec as testicle tree. That's what they called the avocado trees. And then they also, the word guacamole is derived from the same Aztec word that means testicle soup.
Wow.
So the next time that you are eating guacamole, its original title was testicle soup in the Aztec lexicon.
I feel like nature gives us good indications for what its fruit and vegetables are good for.
It does. Walnuts are good for your brain. Celery, believe it or not, has components in it that are good for erections. And avocado is good for your boys.
Hey, Ben and Rachel. My name's Justine from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My boyfriend and I listen to your podcast all the time. We especially love all the propeller hat information. Currently, I'm in school for nutrition, so naturally, I get a lot of questions from friends and family about what they should eat. And I have a hard time not going straight into explaining the gut microbiome and hormones and things of that nature. So I guess my question would be, if you were to give, let's say, a 20-minute class on nutrition to people who know next to nothing about it, what would be your main points? All right. Thanks. Love the show. Keep up the good work. Bye.
So Rachel, how old are these people that I'm giving this 20-minute class to? These like 5-year-olds or preschoolers?
It's everyone. It's a diverse age range.
Everyone. Okay. Yeah. So I've got this platform to the world, and I've got 20 minutes to tell them everything they need to know about nutrition.
That's correct, Ben. You're on.
Can I do the Michael Pollan thing and just say, eat food, mostly plants, not too much?
That's very succinct, but yeah. I feel like you've got more for us.
Okay. All right. So there's so many ways I could go with this, but I'll give you five. Count them, five. I'll give you five big tips when it comes to things that I think everybody should know about when it comes to nutrition that not enough people know about. So the first thing I would say would be everybody needs to know something about calories. So a lot of people think that calories in and calories out are what are called independent variables. And what that means is, for example, you could drop your energy intake and you could maintain your resting metabolic rate while burning the same amount of energy, digesting food and working out, and you'd lose fat. But in reality, the amount and the type of the calories that you eat are going to affect the amount of energy you expend. So calories in and calories out are not independent variables. They're actually dependent variables. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that the type of foods that you grab to eat are going to have a different metabolic effect on your body, even if they have a similar amount of calories. So whole foods, for example, there's one study where they gave people a whole food sandwich, which was basically multi-grain bread with cheddar cheese. And then they gave another group of subjects a processed food sandwich, which was basically white bread with cheese whiz, which actually sounds kind of good in a way. A white bread cheese whiz sandwich. I would try that at least once.
Oh, good.
Anyway, so both meals were isocaloric, and they had pretty much the same macronutrient ratios, the same protein, fat, and carb ratios. However, when they measured their metabolism, the people who ate the multi-grain sandwiches with the cheddar cheese expended 137 calories as far as their what's called their postprandial metabolic rate, whereas the white bread group only expended 73 calories. Wow. So the white bread group only expended 50% of the calories as a whole grain group digesting that food, even though the food itself had the same number of calories.
Right.
So calories in and calories out are not independent variables. Protein is another example of this. So a protein has a huge what's called energy expenditure or thermic effect from being digested, even more so than fats and more so than carbs. And as a matter of fact, there was one study where they looked at a low-fat, high-carb, high-protein diet, which I don't necessarily endorse as a diet, but it does increase what's called your postprandial energy expenditure by up to 100%. And so this idea of consuming some amount of proteins to increase the thermic effect of foods is also smart. Now, I could get into the potential for ammonia toxicity and how there's this potential anti-longevity effect of eating too much proteins, et cetera. But proteins are a good example of how a certain food, a certain macronutrient is going to cause more calories to be burnt by digesting it compared to, say, like fats or carbs. So that's the first thing I would want people to know is that when you look at the calorie label of a food, the calorie label of a food does not really influence the actual number of net calories that body is going to produce inside your body. Okay. So that is number one. That's the first. Does that make sense?
Kind of. I'm not going to lie. I got a little scowl in my head right now.
Okay. All right. So just to clarify real quick, basically what it means is that some foods are going to require way more energy to burn than other foods from a caloric standpoint. Protein and fiber are two perfect examples of that.
Great.
That's basically what that comes down to. Okay, the next thing that you have to understand is that not everyone is going to respond to calories equally. So staying on this calorie bandwagon, for example, what they found is that people who are overweight or obese already have what is called insulin resistance. And these type of folks respond to a caloric intake of, for example, lower carbohydrate, higher fat foods better. There's plenty of literature that shows that for someone who's already obese or overweight, they seem to do best on a lower carb, higher fat diet. And then some people who are insulin sensitive and very lean can get away with, from a fat loss standpoint, like a more moderate amount of carbs or what might not be considered low carb. So that's one example of like the macronutrient ratios or the type of calories that you consume not being responded to equally depending on your body type. We can also look at someone who's like, two different people who weigh 200 pounds and one person is 10% body fat and another person is 20% body fat. Well, let's say that both of those folks eat, say, a baked potato, right? Like a 200 calorie baked potato. Well, the person who has the lower percentage body fat, who has significantly more muscle, that means they have a larger propensity to be able to store carbohydrates. So a much greater percentage of those carbohydrates are going to get shoved into muscle tissue, whereas the second person with significantly less muscle is going to have less room to store carbohydrates as glycogen, and so they're going to be more likely to shovel that glucose into the liver to get converted into fat. And so what that means is that depending on where you're at in life from a fitness standpoint and from a muscle standpoint, you might be able to do better on higher or lower amounts of carbohydrate compared to, say, your neighbor.
Yes, so, that makes sense.
Yep. Okay. All right, cool. So we know that different foods are going to have a different thermic effect. We know that different people are going to respond differently to different amounts of carbohydrate. And then if we want to take this one step further, and this is something we talked about a few podcast episodes back, but your ancestry is going to influence your diet as well.
Yeah.
And there are specific examples of this. So there are some people who would have had a very high what's called folate intake. Okay, so lots of folic acid from like dark leafy greens and vegetables and stuff like that in their ancestors' diet. And people with sufficiently high intakes of folic acid, they would have been selected for what's called an MTHFR mutation.
MTHFR mutation.
And yeah, we were talking about this. You were in Spokane a few days ago, and we were at dinner with some folks, and you mentioned that you had an MTHFR mutation, as folks do when they're eating dinner at a restaurant.
Of course. That's what we talk about when we work together.
Fantastic dinner conversation. And so if you have an MTHFR mutation, if you've been genetically tested for that, it probably means your ancestors had a diet that was rich in folate. And that would suggest that you may be somebody who really needs to focus on getting a lot of vegetables and plants in your diet. And you would be naturally drawn towards a plant-based diet. And you may, because you have what's called a poor methylation status, you may not actually do quite as well with high amounts of methyl groups from meat.
That makes perfect sense.
And yeah, so you, Rachel, you're a vegetarian, you're drawn to a plant-based diet, you have an MTHFR mutation, and that kind of makes sense. Whereas some people who don't have that MTHFR mutation, it's possible that your ancestors may have eaten a different diet. And so MTHFR is one thing to look into. There's also a salivary amylase. There's another gene that codes for salivary amylase production. And the more of that gene is called AMY1. The more of that gene that you produce, the more salivary amylase that you produce in response to carbohydrate intake, and the less likely carbohydrates are to spike your blood glucose. And so if you tend to come from a genetic ancestry that is high in that particular form of salivary amylase, you would have a better metabolic response to starch digestion, and you could get away with more like potatoes and sweet potatoes and roots and tubers and fruits and rice and things, you know, that maybe the things that would make your neighbor fat, you would do just fine with.
Right.
So that's another thing to consider, is this whole idea behind the genes that code for salivary amylase production. And then there is lactate persistence. So some people will do very, very well with dairy because they have this lactase persistence gene. What that means is that the gene that's responsible for digesting lactose sticks around into adulthood. And you'll see this a lot of times in, you know, groups like the Maasai, which is like a hunter-gatherer group in Africa, where because milk is such a staple in their diet, lactase tends to stick around for a long period of time. Whereas in, like, you know, for example, Indian populations, you tend to see very low levels of lactase persistence, and they don't do well on dairy at all.
Yeah.
And so basically what this comes down to is that, you know, one of the only ways to really know is to test your genes, and also means that that really cool diet book that your neighbor got that caused them to lose 20 pounds of fat might not actually work for you. Or the person who switched to a vegan diet in your neighborhood,
right,
and, you know,
is doing great on it,
preaching to the whole world about how well they feel. Well, if your ancestors ate a high folate diet, you might carry things that interact with folate status, and eating more folate rich foods could improve your health and your performance. But if that's not the case, and if you don't have the MTHFR mutation, then, you know, you might need to take another route when it comes to the type of foods that
you consume. This is why there's no one-size-fits-all diet for everyone. Yeah.
Okay. So those are the first three things. That's the first three things I would say is calories in, calories out are not independent variables. Everyone does not respond to calories equally. Your neighbor's diet may not work for you. And then the last couple of things. Understand digestibility versus nutrient density. So take quinoa, for example. Quinoa is a really good amino acid and fatty acid rich grain, or pseudo grass or pseudo grain, whatever you want to call it. But quinoa is high in a coating. It's called saponin. It's a soap-like irritant that the plant produces as a protective mechanism that would theoretically cause a mammal who consumes quinoa to go and poop it out somewhere because it irritates the digestive tract. It doesn't get digested completely. And so a new, fresh new quinoa plant will grow wherever it has been pooped out by that mammal. And so quinoa is certainly nutrient dense, right? So it satisfies that category of amino acids and fatty acids and minerals and vitamins, but it's not very digestible. Unless you make it digestible, right? Unless you soak it and you rinse it, and maybe soak it and rinse it a few more times, and then cook it really thoroughly.
Right.
Soy would be another perfect example of this, right? Like soy can be high in a lot of things that can reduce mineral absorption, like phytic acids, and it can have a lot of what are called phytoestrogenic properties, which could cause, you know, guys to get man boobs and stuff like that, or women who have estrogen dominance to have even higher levels of estrogen dominance when consuming soy. But if we take that soy and we ferment it and we make like soybeans into natto and we make a soy paste into miso and we ferment soy to make things like tempeh, all of a sudden the soy becomes digestible, and that really good plant protein that was nutrient dense in the first place but not digestible is all of a sudden something that's digestible. So understand that a lot of nutrient-dense foods that are out there are not necessarily foods that are going to do you any favors and may actually cause food allergy responses and immune system issues and inflammation unless you render them digestible via things like, you know, like the sourdough bread process that we talked about, and fermenting and soaking and rinsing and sprouting. And you could find things that are indeed digestible right off the bat, right? Like processed sugar. That's extremely digestible, but it's not nutrient-dense.
Right.
Or white bread with cheese whiz. Very digestible, but not nutrient dense. So what I always look at when I'm considering whether or not I want to include a food in my diet, no matter how many carbs or fats or proteins or what the percentages of those are, I always ask myself, is it nutrient dense and is it digestible? And if the answer to those two questions is yes, then it's a definite inclusion in my diet. Does that make sense?
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Okay, cool. I'm glad.
It's a big one.
No scowl on your face from that one. And then the final one is that you probably eat too much and too often. And this is something I have had clients who I have spent time with, and I will go through the day with them, and I'll do my usual, you know, eat 2 to 3 square meals a day, breakfast sometimes, and, you know, always like a salad for lunch and dinner. And then my clients will do the same, and then I'll kind of watch them out of the corner of my eye, and they're like, eating pumpkin seeds out of a bag and having an energy bar. And then after dinner, you know, I'm going to have some chia seeds and some dark chocolate. And then, oh, I grabbed this kombucha, the one from, you know, Whole Foods. It's got 30 calories, and actually it's 30 calories and there's two servings in a bottle. So it's 60 calories.
Right.
And I start to look at people's diet and people who can't lose weight no matter what. And when you really start to inspect things, you know, then they have their cup of bulletproof coffee before they have their eggs and their bacon. Mm-hmm. And people, if you really step back and look at it, and I would challenge everybody to look at this, sometimes you find that you're just eating all day long, even though you're not thinking about it, or even though those choices seem to be really healthy. Some people just freaking need to stop eating so much, period. Yeah. Like it's one of the biggest things that I see. And I'll even audit people's diets and I'll look at the diet and I'll say, there's no way that this is what you're eating, right? Like your tiny little 200 calorie green smoothie for breakfast and your 500 calorie lunchtime salad. And then your 600 calorie fish and roasted vegetables for dinner. And you know, you're gaining weight. And then we really start to dig in and they're like, well, you know, I do have, you know, I put, you know, MCT oil in my tea in the morning. I'm like, okay, that's 400 calories. And I have my kombucha and I'm like, okay, that's 70 or 100 mm-hmm. calories. And then, oh, I put a little bit of sugar in my coffee. Okay, there's another 50. And I had a handful of seeds and nuts, but it was a healthy trail mix. I'm like, okay, that's 400 calories. And, you know, a lot of times people just eat too much food. There's no evidence that grazing or snacking is going to elevate your metabolism. There's plenty of evidence that restricted eating and intermittent fasting can shift you into a higher level of fat burning and increased fat oxidation. So that's the fifth thing I would say, is you just probably eat too damn much and too often.
Yeah, and I suppose we associate eating with just the three big meals of the day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so we don't really think about what's actually happening in between. And we're all very busy people. So I guarantee we're not spending our days thinking about what we're actually eating.
Yep.
Which exactly. We should.
Exactly. So those are my five things that you must know about nutrition. Now, before we move on to the next part of today's podcast, Rachel, we have another tip. I've got another tip here from our friend Jordan Harbinger at The Art of Charm. So you can check out Jordan's website. He's a friend of mine. You can go to theartofcharm.com or you can go to iTunes and just do a search for Art of Charm Podcast. But now is the time on the show when we play a special tip from our friend Jordan. So Jordan, take it away.
I've noticed that really athletic people, especially the more athletic they get, tend to be very dominant personalities. This happens a lot. And what this means is that nonverbally, in terms of your facial and nonverbal communication, your body language, it can make you come across a little bit aloof, a little bit unfriendly. So what we're going to do today is called the doorway drill. And what this means is every time you walk through a doorway, straighten up, stand up straight, chest up, chin up, smile on your face, shoulders back. Now, don't exaggerate this, you'll look a little bit like a knuckle dragging idiot, but we want you straight up, really erect. And what this will do every time you walk through a doorway, if you do this, what this is going to do is program you to really fine tune this as your default body language. So I want you doing this at home, on when you leave your bedroom, when you go into the bathroom, when you leave your own house. What this does is it drills this level of default body language down to the level of habit. And this is great because that means you don't have to think about it anymore. This is a really great drill if you get nervous in groups or in social situations or in situations in which you're a little bit uncomfortable no matter what, because it gets good open body language down to the level of habit, so you don't need to think about it anymore. Once you do the doorway drill enough, you never have to think about this again. So that means that when you're in interactions with other people, when you're at a coffee shop, restaurant, networking event, at work, in the office, you don't have to think about micromanaging your nonverbal communication. You already know you're getting a great first impression. You already know that your nonverbal communication is on point because you've made this a habit. This is really, really powerful because it frees you up to think about other things and become more present when you're interacting with other people, thereby making you more charismatic. Can't beat that.
So, Rachel, have you actually tried this since listening to Jordan's tip?
I haven't, no, but I'm absolutely going to. I think it's brilliant.
I think it is too. And I have actually been going out of my way, not that I go to too many cocktail parties, but I speak a lot and I go to conferences, and it is actually quite helpful when you stop at the expo doors of the conference, or you stop right before you walk into the room, or before you knock on the door of someone's house, and you just do a little postural adjustment or a little power pose. I really like this. You could even use it before you step into the gym, you know, before you step into spin class at the gym. So,
and it's an easy way to make something into a habit as well. I think he actually mentioned, did he say to do it through all doorways so it gets ingrained?
Exactly.
Yeah, all doorways. Yep. So when you're walking through doorways in your house, even. Yep.
When you're walking into the bathroom to take a crap, flex your biceps, get your body ready.
Yeah.
So
it's a brilliant tip.
Now, we also, speaking of tips, we have a wonderful review, a 5-star review that was left on iTunes. And we always like to, out of the goodness of our hearts, spread the good karma and give things away to people who leave a review on iTunes. Mm-hmm. So if you go to iTunes, you leave our show some stars and you say something nice and you email us, if you hear us read your review on the show, you simply email gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. That's gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. Let us know your t-shirt size, and we'll send you a super-duper cool gift back with a beanie and a BPA-free water bottle that's not going to give you man boobs, and a cool tech t-shirt. And we actually have a review this week that I chose because it was left by a man or a woman with a very interesting handle on iTunes. So, Rachel, yeah. what was the name of this particular reviewer?
I feel like it just is perfect with today's theme as well.
Mm. Take it away.
It just fits perfectly. Okay, so the review is by Banana Penis.
Banana Penis.
Banana Penis.
Ah.
And
great name.
And the title is Thank You, Ben, 5 stars.
What does Banana Penis have to say?
I started listening to this podcast around 2 years ago. Ben is my go-to resource for anything health and fitness related. He is a stickler on research and is not afraid to challenge any of his guest theories and recommendations. I've transformed my health and fitness for the better, and I owe a lot of it to this podcast. I also enjoy his new sidekick, Rachel. Mm. Aw, thanks, Banana Penis.
And he spells your name Rachel.
Rachael.
So I'm guessing Banana Penis must be from some exotic island somewhere.
Maybe.
Robes. I call myself a Banana Penis man. Rachael, my new sidekick.
Oh, the accent's back. I love it.
The accent is back. All right. Now I'm an evil Russian missile designer named Banana Penis, the name of my new nuclear missile.
Okay, so if you want to leave a review, go to iTunes, leave a review. 5 stars are always much appreciated. It helps to spread the word about this show. And what we have done is we have compiled everything that we've talked about in today's show, from the special discounts on like the Paleo Conference and the Biohackers Conference, to the new home kit that Wellness FX has introduced, to the Training Peaks heart rate variability, to the sourdough bread recipes, to the Greenfield Fitness Systems gift box, to the avocado seed video, everything. Just go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com/347. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com/347, and all the goodies will be there for you. Now, we will have a special episode coming next Wednesday because I will be off in the hills of Kauai somewhere hiking around and working on my tan.
Living in bliss.
But in the meantime, stay tuned for a special episode this weekend on pulsed electromagnetic field therapy, just in case you want more nerdiness. And also next week for an even specialer episode, which I will, I'm going to keep that a secret for now. So anyways, BenGreenfieldFitness.com/347. Check it out. Rachel, enjoy your day.
Adios.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.